Welcome, everybody. I'm Rachel DeGolia, Executive Director of the Universal Health Care Action Network and a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. Our theme tonight is the latest drug settlement, new opportunities to correct misinformation. Let me give a little background on this call for those of you who are joining us for the first time. This conflict-free leadership call is hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its unbranded doctor project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, affectionately known as PACME grant. The PACME grant is a result of a state attorney general settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. And partners for the grant, including the NPA, also include American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. And I believe we have staff, we generally have staff for all those organizations on the call. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession and medical research. The partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness of the issue and to build leadership in the medical profession to eventually eliminate some of these conflicts. And for more information, you can visit the NPA website, Unbranded Doctor website, which you can click on at npalliance.org. So here's how we're going to run the call today. First of all, Becky, you want to give us a rundown on the states we have people from what states we have people on the call tonight?
Sure. We have folks on the call tonight from Connecticut and from Washington, D.C., Florida, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, North Carolina, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Washington State.
Wow. All right. So these calls usually draw people from that many states, and we usually have a pretty good mix of med students and faculty and practicing physicians, so it's pretty exciting. All right, so here's how we're going to run the call tonight. Our featured speakers will each give a 15-minute presentation at the most, 10 to 15 minutes, and we'll have time for a couple questions in between after the first speaker and again after the second, and then we'll throw it open. Hopefully most of the last half of the call we'll have for Q&A and discussion with everybody. And what we ask to make the questioning go a little more smoothly is that as questions occur to you, we invite you to email them to Ann Wollison, who is NPA's education director, at ann.wollison, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. Ann.Wollison at npalliance.net. And then Ann will read out the questions for us, and that way people don't need to be interrupting each other. And if we run out of time to answer all the questions that get emailed to Ann, we will commit to making sure you get a response following the call via email. So Ann, would you like to say a few words?
Yeah, just really quickly, and thanks everybody for joining us tonight for what's going to be a very informative call. And Rachel did a great job introducing the project, so I just wanted to give you a couple quick updates. First of all, for people who are new to these calls, this is the fifth of a series offered by the National Physicians Alliance as part of a partnership to advance conflict-free medical education. And past calls are archived on NPA's website and can be found on the homepage under the latest from the NPA under conflict-free medical education. So you can find that just by going to the homepage. Secondly, I just wanted to mention that as part of this work, the National Physicians Alliance is offering CME-accredited, nationally webcasted brand rounds related to conflict of interest issues, and the next one is scheduled to occur during NPA's annual conference on November 10th at 1:15 in the afternoon, the title of which is Selling Drugs, Pharma's Evolving Strategies, and it will describe in detail the industry's marketing strategies toward physicians, the use of technology, and other strategies involving the use of coupons to steer people toward more expensive drugs. So I hope you can join us for that.
And that's in Washington, or in Alexandria, Virginia.
Right. And you can find out about the conference and the National Grand Rounds and Archive National Grand Rounds, for which you can receive CMEs for, once again, by checking out NPA's website, the homepage, latest from the NPA. It's right there. So I'll stop there. I just want to reach out. Has Adrian made it onto the call?
I don't hear yet. Well, we might just start with Wells then, if that's the case. Maybe you want to give Adrian a quick call or send a shooter an email in?
Yep, I just shot her an email, and I'll give her a call.
Okay.
Just want to confirm she's not there, and we'll start with Wells.
If you're
with Wells.
Okay.
Sure, that's fine. That's fine.
So what I'm going to do is introduce them both right now, say give their a little bit about each of them. You saw this also, I think, in the announcement. Adrian Hugh Berman is an associate professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Physiology in the Department of Family Medicine at Georgetown University Medical Center, and also director of Farmed Out, which I hope she will tell us more about. Dr. Hugh Berman will present on how the pharmaceutical industry uses medical science liaisons and key opinion leaders to promote drugs off-label, and we'll discuss off-label promotion in the recent settlement between Johnson & Johnson and the Department of Justice. So if she gets on the call, we'll have her first. And then my second speaker will be Wells Wilkinson, JD, who is director of PAL, the Prescription Access Litigation Project, and staff attorney with the Community Catalyst. Mr. Wilkinson will present on opportunities industry settlements present to fund independent prescriber education as an appropriate remedy for illegal off-label drug promotion. Again, as you hear our speakers, please feel free to email your questions as they occur to you to ann.wolosson, ann.wolosson, at npalliance.net. And Ann will share them with us, and that way it'll be a little bit more ordered than if we had people all trying to speak up at once. Adrian, did you join us? If Adrian hasn't, we'll start with Wells. Okay, I don't hear her, so we're going to start with Wells. Okay?
Sure.
All right, take away.
All right, great. Thank you, Rachel and Ann and NPA for inviting me to speak with all about off-label drug promotion and the settlements related to that conduct. Again, I'll just tell you a little bit about PAL briefly. The Prescription Access Litigation Project was founded back in 2001 to try to use litigation to try to confront some of the unfair and deceptive practices by the drug industry and that were kind of driving up drug prices and preventing access to affordable medicines. And our real mission has been both to promote access to affordable pharmaceutical treatments for patients, usually through promoting access to generic drugs, and then also to try to oppose the marketing that is become so rampant to try to promote drugs that people just don't need, or to promote very expensive drugs over equally effective and sometimes more effective alternatives. And so PAL has been involved in about 32 class action settlements that have yielded about 32 class action losses that have yielded about 17 settlements or so, returning, I believe, just over $1 billion to consumers.
Wow.
And third-party payers. So we're very proud of that. I will disclose, however, that PAL has never received any funds from any of the settlements we've been involved in. Unfortunately, we would like to be more actively involved in some of these cases, and we're working on ways that we can do that. But we've been funded by foundations almost exclusively throughout the 10 years we've been around. So, but we know with these settlements, and those are private sector settlements that we've been mostly involved in. But we've seen over the last 8 years or so, about 23 different settlements by the Department of Justice or the state's attorneys general around off-label promotion of drugs. And we're becoming increasingly concerned about this conduct and how this widespread conduct by so many of these major drug manufacturers, practically every large manufacturer, has admitted or pled guilty to off-label promotion. And that's clearly illegal under federal law. And, you know, at this point, it's estimated that between 20% and 40% of prescribing is done off-label. Now, y'all, as doctors, know better than I that there certainly are some off-label uses of drugs that are justified and even necessary. But analyses that have been done have shown that, you know, between or around 70% of off-label prescribing or off-label uses of drugs, you know, are done with no real evidence of the drug being effective. And that number is even higher in certain classes of drugs like mental health drugs. So we're very concerned about this kind of from two perspectives. One is that you know, this off-label prescribing, even after settlement happens, we're concerned that it continues to occur because there's really no corrective action going on to try to correct the misinformation that's been spread throughout the medical community about the off-label uses of these drugs. And Dr. Hugh Verman will just talk a little bit about how that misinformation gets so effectively placed. But one of the solutions that we've proposed to this is to try to earmark some settlement funds to finance independent prescriber education efforts. Sometimes they're called academic detailing efforts. And that's basically paying a medical professional to go out into the field with information about kind of therapeutic best practices for treating certain conditions, and to try to have these people go out and meet with doctors and explain what, after reviewing the kind of full breadth of medical evidence, explain what are the best practices and the best therapeutic treatments in each particular class. Now, there's a legal argument to be made that in the course of these settlements, you know, the attorneys are only really, you know, solving half of the problem. They're getting a settlement in dollars that goes back to the federal government, either the feds or the states through the Medicaid programs. And that is good in a way, but unfortunately, most of the settlements have actually recovered, you know, usually less than 5% of the money that is actually made on the sale of these drugs. And so it's really not a large enough amount to really be seen as anything less than just the cost of doing business by the drug manufacturers. Now, the first change that where the number went up a little higher was the big Pfizer settlement of $2.3 billion back in 2010, I believe. And so that settlement was actually about 14% of the gross revenue from the sale of the drugs that were involved in that litigation. So that's, you know, it's a little bigger bite of the apple, but, you know, it's still not 50%. It's not nearly enough. Now, there are risks with litigation, and so if you hold out and go to trial, you may get nothing. You may fail to prove your case on a legal technicality or face other problems. So I understand why the government, federally and at the state level, may be settling for recoveries that are 10 or 15% of their actual damages. I can understand that. But what we'd like to see is that they earmark some of the funds to turn around and spend on re-educating prescribers who have for years been told that one of these uses of the drug, you know, are effective to treat, say, dementia in seniors in the case of Zyprexa. And so we've been advocating with some attorneys generals and some other folks at CMS that we start earmarking some funds to re-educate prescribers. And in the current climate, I have to say, you know, all the state budgets are really, really hurting right now. And so the monies that are going back to the Medicaid programs, I think it's very hard for them politically to look at doing anything with them other than just funding the program and keeping it going. So I can understand that that's still a counter pressure, even if you have a good legal argument, you know, which we think we do. So we want to try to figure out a new strategy to try to make funding re-education of both physicians and also patients who are being treated by these off-label uses of drugs, try to make that become more of a priority to try to help improve the quality of care for patients going forward. You know, one of the problems that we kind of see is that if you only recover money that you've lost in the past, you don't have the opportunity to talk to doctors about why the information they got from the drug companies was false or incorrect. And you also miss the opportunity to then try to teach them the other therapeutic alternatives that might exist to treat the conditions that they were using this one drug for.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we've looked recently, I just, for the first time, counted up all the different settlements since 2004. There are about 23 different settlements. And the total amount of money is $8.6 billion. That's a huge amount of money. And so if you compare that to the amount of money that's going into re-educating doctors or consumers about how they've been affected by these illegal promotional activities by the drug companies, the only two examples I can find in that record are the $28 million that was earmarked in the Neurontin settlement by the attorneys general, and it's funding the PACME project that both NPA and my organization Community Catalyst are receiving funds for, and it funded some other work that was done by a number of different organizations to create educational materials for physicians, and it also in part funded Consumer Reports Best Buy Drugs, which continues to be a really good resource for consumers to learn about therapeutic alternatives to certain expensive brand name drugs. So there's that one example of funding, and the only other example I've seen of any kind of requirement to re-educate doctors was one mention of in the Seroquel settlement of $520 million, there's a requirement that the drug maker AstraZeneca send a letter to all the prescribers informing them of the fact that they were settling an investigation into their off-label marketing practices, and those practices were illegal. And I thought at the time when I saw that, it was a good start. It certainly was a signal that the Department of Justice recognizes that we need to do something to re-educate physicians about the misinformation that they've received, but unfortunately sending one letter to a doctor after the drug industry representatives have been visiting them week after week for probably the last 2 years, it's really not going to have an impact. And so we've been advocating that some money go to fund these academic detailing programs. There are currently, or at least as of 2010, there were active academic detailing programs in about 10 states, and they get a variety of different sources of funding. Some of them are very small pilot programs that were started by Medicaid, and others, like in Pennsylvania, are funded by a lottery, and then some of them here in Massachusetts, for instance, are funded through a state budget allocation. And so, the nice thing is that in some of these states, these programs already exist, and they're desperate for funding. So you don't have the kind of startup costs you might have, but we've seen that the startup costs are actually rather low because there are organizations that have created all the curricula that these academic detailers might need, and so all you have to do is hire the people and help them decide which providers they're going to reach out to. So, I do have some questions I'd like to hear y'all discuss, and one of them is, in your experience, do you ever see any kind of corrective information after one of these big settlements happens? Have you ever seen, other organizations or insurers try to kind of issue information or warnings about some of these off-label promotional activities? Or just amongst yourselves, do you as physicians talk about these kinds of settlements and what they could mean? I'd be really curious to hear your opinions on those things.
All right. Well, so Wells has pitched a question for everybody on the call. If there's someone who would like to respond to that right now, I invite you to hit *6 and unmute your line if you muted it and chime in. Anybody want to do that right now or we a little bit later?
I can speak to that. This is Mark Ryan in Richmond. I would say that I usually don't hear these coming in any organized way from anybody. Usually when these things come up, it's something I hear about through some of the MPA's work with some of the grants that have resulted from them, but also I'll see them in a journal, I'll catch them in a headline, we'll discuss it, you know, amongst our listserv or something, but yeah, I can't say that it makes any particular impression. It certainly doesn't show up, for example, if you go to some of the conferences at the, you know, it would be really kind of nifty if the company that were there advertising their product also had to have big disclaimers or big warnings, you know, in a way that were publicly visible, kind of like wearing, you know, sandwich boards in public with them. But of course, that never comes up. So if you bring it up, if you try to bring it up, the reps usually will kind of downplay, well, there was no admission of fault. Oh, well, there was no actual finding of guilt. Unfortunately, I think you're right. As much as these can be really gratifying and they can really make the point if you're paying attention, you have to be paying attention.
Mark, I think your idea of requiring the industry to put this information out there in the public at conferences that they attend, I think that's a great idea.
It would be a pretty compelling thing to require them to put ads in the conference program saying, we, you know, misled you for 20 years on gabapentin, or to put signs at all the booths, every booth that you have as a company, big signs, you know, signs that are visible.
Kind of like a warning on the cigarette pack, right?
Yeah, yeah. you know, to just sort of say, if you really did wrong and you've misled prescribers for years, then own up to it. Be straight up, be honest, and don't you're not able to hide it. You don't have the right to hide it.
Does anybody else want to add to what Mark just said in response to Will's question? If not right now, do you have an email question for Wells, Ann?
I have a couple.
Okay, why don't you make one of them?
Okay. You kind of answered this sort of, I guess. Are there existing academic detailing programs using settlement funds?
Oh, good question. Yes, I am not aware of any settlement funds from off-label settlements or any other kind of settlement, for instance, being used for academic detailing or, you know, re-educating prescribers about the off-label promotions that they were subjected to. You know, there are examples of other settlements in the past that have been used to kind of educate consumers. Some of the kind of illegal kind of and deceptive practices around all sorts of kind of older practices, like there's a vitamin case, for instance, promotion of vitamins through unclaimed or unsubstantiated claims of benefits, etc. There are a few examples where some of those monies have gone to educate consumers, but you know, the amounts have been kind of rather small, I have to say. But there are no examples of them funding academic detailing right now.
And then as a follow-up to that, how would an existing program or a new program access settlement funds?
That's a great question. So I think you know, we face a kind of political problem in large part, and that is that when Medicaid recovers funds from one of these settlements, the Medicaid programs are all funded by state budgets, and they're increasingly becoming, you know, 30-40% of some state budgets or so. Healthcare costs overall, but Medicaid is oftentimes the biggest component of that. So there's pressure there to use all of those funds just to keep the programs afloat. And so I think the way to try to make this happen is to kind of create pressure on attorneys general that this kind of re-education has to happen, and it has to be considered additional to the settlement funds that they're already providing. And so it's really kind of making the companies not only pay you, 15% of the costs that their illegal promotions caused, but then also have to pay for a 2-year effort to re-educate prescribers about drugs in that class of therapeutic treatment that actually have evidence of efficacy. Right. And so, if you think a little bit about that, I think one thing that a lot of attorneys general and lawyers and there's other kind of politicians and people would have a little bit of difficulty understanding is that physicians don't know when the use of a drug is on or off label. I mean, I think that's a hard thing for lay people to understand. And it was hard for me to understand initially, because I would have thought that would be one of the essential things that doctors would have to kind of learn. But I now understand that the world of medicine is very complex and drugs are very complex, and there's so many drugs out there, that it's probably unreasonable to expect physicians to know all that. And there also aren't really good resources, I think, for physicians to select prescription drug treatments. Some insurers provide them. There is Consumer Best Buy Drugs, which is really oriented for consumers, but I think is equally useful to physicians in some contexts. But the difficulty is convincing attorneys general that doctors have to be re-educated with these funds, when they're concerned about keeping the state, the state Medicaid program running. And so I've been trying to think about this somewhat recently in talking to other people, and Anne actually is when she kind of asked me to do this. And one thing I'm beginning to think about a little bit more is that we need to try to engage the patients as well. And so the patients that are, continue to be receiving an off-label use of a drug like Zyprexa or Paxil or something like that, they, I think, have a right to know that their use of this drug has been promoted through the illegal practices of the drug manufacturer who took advantage of the physician and misled the physician in a very concerted, active way. And I think that might help to kind of reinforce to attorneys general, who are really just politicians at a certain level, reinforce to them that re-educating doctors and also engaging and educating consumers about the misinformation that occurred and the alternatives that they really should be trying, I think is one of the ways we might generate enough political pressure to start generating some funds for academic detailing.
Very good, Wells. All right. Has Dr. Hugh Berman joined us? And did you connect with her, Anne?
Yeah, I've called her and I've emailed her, and I haven't received a response. And it's odd because we did just talk earlier this week. So I hope she's okay.
Yeah.
I also left her the call and information in both the email and the phone call. So I'm not quite sure what to say about that. And I don't want to put Wells on the spot, but I do have a couple of other questions.
Yeah, so let's just go on with some more questions here. And if she joins us, that'll be great. Hopefully she's okay. And maybe we can have her on a future call if she doesn't make it for today.
I just want to follow up with what Wells was saying in answering that last question about how do programs maybe access these settlement funds. And I just want to let people know that in the state of Maine, we have a very small academic detailing program, but it's pretty effective, and it's administered by the Maine Medical Association, and they have written a request to the Attorney General in Maine seeking that a small portion of the funds that it received under this latest Johnson & Johnson settlement.
That's the one that Nathan was going to tell us about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be earmarked to Maine's academic detailing program. So I'd be willing to sort of share what that proposal and letter looks like with folks if they're interested in seeing it. And it is interesting, depending on what state you're in, to look at the settlement language specific to this particular case, because when you look at the settlement language and what that money can be used for, it's clear that academic detailing or independent prescriber education is allowable use under the settlement language. And I think, Wells, I think I shared that. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, you did share that settlement, a copy of that settlement with me, and I looked at it briefly, and I do think that it's a great opportunity for the advocates to try to get their attorneys general to fund these kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another question, Marianne? Remember,
yeah.
Let me just repeat Ann's email again for people who would like to submit questions. ann.wolosson, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, so we have, I actually have four questions sort of backed up here.
All right.
And the first is kind of a general, more general question. What is the chance we'll ever see into DTC, direct-to-consumer advertising for medications? And I don't know if there's a clear answer to that question, but I don't know if that's something that you would want to speak to or not.
What was the beginning of the question, what is the chances we might see an end to DTCA?
Yep.
Yeah.
Advertising for medication.
Sure. Well, I'd be happy to talk about that. I have done some work on direct-to-consumer advertising. And, you know, there's one real significant development that's kind of on hold right now. I think, just between the folks of us on the call, I think, you know, part of it might be just in terms of political timing. It may be expedient to hold this off until after the election. But the FDA has been promulgating new rules about direct-to-consumer advertising, and they would actually require much stronger and clearer presentations of the risks of drugs in the ads, and that would have to be done in a way that there are no happy images being shown on the screen while you're hearing the litany of all the possible adverse events or side effects that could be associated with the drug. And we all know when we see the ads today, when they're listing all the different, possible but serious side effects, they're showing happy images to try to get you not to think about them. And so there's a new law passed in 2007 that required FDA to issue new rules around these televised direct-to-consumer ads for drugs. And FDA finally in middle of 2010 issued preliminary rules that would require ads to present information at a very slow pace, kind of like I'm speaking now, so that everyone could understand what the risks are, and to do it at an educational level that would be, kind of acceptable to all potential members of the public. And also do it in a way where there's no distracting images on the screen. And so FDA has been sitting on that rulemaking process for, now we're looking at 2 years or so. I think that's shameful. I think a lot of people have, bought a lot of drugs based on ads in the last 2 years or so. But I do think that once these requirements come out, they're going to make drug ads be longer. They're going to actually require much clearer explanations of the risks of the drugs. And I think it may change the importance that drug manufacturers kind of place on direct-to-consumer advertising. But I'll also say that, I'm much more concerned about all the marketing that goes on, you know, targeting the prescribers. I mean, drug companies spend probably 4 or 5 times as much marketing to doctors than they do on all their advertising to consumers.
Wow.
You know, the drug industry has a, you know, this information is probably about 2 years old, so there have been some layoffs since then, but the drug industry has an army of salespeople, the drug detailers out there, and you know there are about 85,000 of them, and so there's basically one drug salesperson for every 10 doctors. And if you take out the doctors that don't see drug reps, either because they practice in a certain area where they just don't write prescriptions, or they've decided, you know, they're just not going to do that, they don't want to do it, it really means there's one salesperson for every 5 doctors or so. And so, you know, if your job was to get 5 people to do something different every week, i.e. to write prescriptions for your drug, you'd be pretty successful because, that's a lot of attention and focus being paid on each prescriber. And the drug companies know every prescription a doctor writes. They know it, you know, sometimes in almost real time because they gather this information from the pharmacies. And they know every prescription you've ever written. So they know when you're using competing companies' drugs. They know when you're writing generics that are used in the same class as their brand name drug. And they can walk in and hand you a reprint that, you know, shows you that, you know, your drug has been shown to treat, to be more effective than, you know, some other drug in treating patients of a certain type or so. And so, you know, I think it's very easy for doctors to be manipulated because they don't always know that the drug companies are able to know so much about the prescriptions that the doctor is writing. But I do have a question for, for the doctors on the call and the med students too, and that is that one thing we have seen in terms of promotion is that the drug companies will engage and hire different doctors who are kind of key opinion leaders, and they'll engage them, to go out and speak on behalf of their drug products, and they also get them to just go out within the medical community and talk about a certain drug and how effective, they may see it to be, et cetera. And so there's this peer-to-peer education that goes on. And one thing I'm kind of wondering is if there's a model for kind of an academic detailing program that's not so much just the traditional model of, sending a trained person in to meet with doctors, et cetera, but is there also perhaps like a peer group model where doctors could talk to each other about, cost-effective therapeutic alternatives? I'm kind of curious if that's something that might be, what y'all think about that?
Anybody want to respond to their question? Hit *6 to unmute your line. Doesn't sound like anybody.
Well, this is Mark again. I didn't want to jump in on top of anybody else.
Go ahead.
So I actually work in an academic health center. We don't deal with detailers with drug reps at all there. So it's kind of nice just having a close-knit group of people that are really focused on evidence-based stuff. I think we are pretty good about avoiding a lot of that influence or calling it out. When we see it. In terms of, the medical students, they also don't see the best either, but I don't know that we do as well in an organized way to teach them when they're eventually out in public, in practice, how to handle these sorts of things. I've had an idea that I've talked around, and I haven't really gone through with it yet, but we have a school of pharmacy that's connected with us, and we have a pretty strong relationship with some of the faculty there, and I've put this idea of some sort of service learning project to use our medical students and our pharmacy students together to go and do some of this academic detailing type model. But we don't have anything really formal otherwise. We don't have anything where docs come together reliably and talk about this unless it's very practice to practice or very individual level type stuff.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This is Lisa Pliny from Seattle, and I would say one source of this kind of thing that I've participated in has been P&T committees. And I happen to have been on ones that were with organizations that were very much interested in being cost-effective and evidence-based, like group health cooperative. And so it's pretty, really pretty biased as far as giving you information on what people do in practice. And also Madigan Army Medical Center. So both of those groups had pretty tight formularies. And we really were able to deal with this kind of problem, and we didn't have the issue. Just like in an academic center, like Mark was just talking about, we didn't have drug reps allowed to come in to either of those facilities, which was great. And I don't know exactly what happens on the pharmacy and therapeutics committees in private practice situations, and how much they help with this. So, you know, I can't help with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way that information is put out, and I know that in both of those groups, we did a lot of education of physicians, and if physicians came, a group came because they wanted a particular drug that was new that would be helpful for their group of patients, you know, we always compared it to what else was on the formulary, and you know, we looked at the tolerability, the effectiveness, all these different aspects of the drug, and they got really good feedback, I think. And they were allowed to present it themselves, and then we would make decisions based, you know, on whether to add the drug to the formulary that were really rational decisions, knowing we had a certain pot of money and a certain number of things to do with that pot. So that's a source of a way to spread information. If the P&T committee would be active at hospitals and clinics and inform the doctors.
Mhm.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to that, or we'll take another question from Ann if not. Okay, Ann.
Okay, I just want to confirm that Adrian hasn't joined us. A couple of beeps. No. Okay. So I guess it's sort of a follow up, but one, the kind of synthesis required to give out corrective info to patients who are taking these drugs. And a similar question would be sort of similar, I guess. Since state Medicaid programs or AGs are concerned about Medicaid programs, the funding going directly back to Medicaid, why, and Medicaid knows who are prescribing these drugs, why can't Medicaid programs use some of those funds to provide education to prescribers to correct this information?
Those are both good questions. So the first question, I wasn't quite sure I heard. I think I heard it was about corrective information for patients, but I didn't hear the beginning.
Can pharmacists be required to give out corrective information to patients who are taking these drugs?
Oh, I see. That's an interesting angle. I'm not sure how you would require a pharmacist to do that, considering the pharmacists don't really have a direct connection with, you know, the drug manufacturers who are subject to these settlements. You know, you could possibly ask them, the attorney generals, the DOJ could possibly ask the manufacturers to provide materials free of charge to pharmacists so they could distribute them with, you know, subsequent prescriptions for those drugs. That's a great idea. That's a fantastic idea. The hard part there would be to kind of ensure that the information, you know, was actually done. And pharmacists, I think, are increasingly overworked, and they're kind of pressured by the PBMs to make less and less on the drugs that they do sell, et cetera. But there might be ways to do that. And you could also probably do the same thing via physicians. You could have physicians who are writing those prescriptions providing information to patients. I think that's an interesting idea too. Why can't a Medicaid program allocate some of these funds to do the provider education? That's certainly, I think, is an option. Again, I think the Medicaid programs are all worried about their sustainability. I mean, in some states, Medicaid funding is so much in jeopardy that they're considering things like limiting all patients to no more than 2 prescriptions, right? Which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever from a kind of therapeutic point of view, because some patients might need 5 very inexpensive prescriptions and some might need none. Sometimes the policy making is not really guided by the best therapeutic decision making.
You're so diplomatic, Wells.
I'm trying to say that right. Yes.
Well, especially if they end up in the emergency room because they're not getting the medications they need.
Well, exactly. I mean, it certainly is. It could be very short. Some of these policies could be very short-sighted. But I think there are a number of states where, the kind of political leadership of the state, they really do as little as they can to provide a good Medicaid program. They provide, only the required benefits and none of the optional benefits, even when the federal government offers to or is allowed to pick up the majority, like 75 or 90% of the costs. Some states still refuse to do that. The state leadership for Medicaid programs cannot always have the best interests of the patients in mind, I think, is probably one of the
biggest
reasons.
Can't you make a cost-effectiveness argument here, too? In terms, doctors are, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be asking questions, I'm the facilitator, but if doctors are prescribing drugs that either don't work or might even be harmful because they don't know that that's not how they should be used, and the Medicaid program's paying for it, and then the Medicaid program ends up with sicker beneficiaries because of that, or beneficiaries who don't get well because of that?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there is a, penny wise, pound foolish aspect to this, but to not correcting the misinformation that's out there. When every month when you fill another prescription for Zyprexa or any of these other expensive brand name drugs, that's $150 down the drain. Compared to a $10 generic that might be in the same class, or or no treatment, or some alternative treatment that might not even be pharmaceutical in nature. So I do think there's not always the best decision making around some of these choices. But I also think that like physicians, some Medicaid programs may not have. This may not be on their radar. So we talked to one Medicaid program after about, 4 or 5 of these big off-label settlements to ask, have you done anything to your formulary to restrict the use of these drugs or to measure whether, or to educate prescribers, through a prior approval process to make sure they're not using it for an off-label purpose that has no proven benefit, or to make sure they know that the off-label information they received from the drug company was false and misleading. And, one Medicaid program we talked to, which we generally think is on top of the ball in many areas, hadn't even thought of it. And so, I think there is, I think Medicaid programs are, I think in a lot of cases, struggling to try to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're up against pharma, which has incredible resources to promote the drugs to the prescribers, and also, in my opinion, to bring groups in to pressure the P&T committees for Medicaid programs to not put restrictions on these drugs. When the industry funding of disease organizations is incredibly high, and these disease groups are the ones that go in and can, on behalf of a narrow number of patients that might need a specific branding drug, they can advocate that a Medicaid program not put any restrictions at all. And I think that ends up being very costly.
Anne, do you have another question for Wells?
I have a couple more here, and there may be others on the phone that could answer this as well. How easily can academic detailing programs be set up in areas where they don't already exist?
That's a good question. So my organization, Community Catalyst, got some funding from the Pew Charitable Trusts a couple of years ago. And, with very small grants of, I think in the neighborhood of $50,000 or $100,000, we engaged different Medicaid programs and started pilot academic detailing programs. And so the amount of money, $50,000 or $100,000 is it's very small compared to the budgets of these state agencies. And so I think that the seed money amount that's needed is very, very low. And there are very good resources available through organizations that have set up academic detailing programs so that all the materials are ready. You can just lift the same modules on how to treat diabetes or hypertension or high cholesterol, etc. All those materials are ready and in the can. And so what you're really talking about is just hiring nurses, physician's assistants, pharmacists, doctors, hiring medical professionals to go out and have some scientific credibility and present this information to physicians in practice. So I don't think the costs are very high. I don't think the logistics are terribly challenging. One kind of hurdle that I think Medicaid programs have to get over is that they send staff out to prescribers who are writing a lot of prescriptions for expensive brand new drugs. There's a concern that it might feel like the Medicaid program is sending in the prescription drug police, and they're coming down on them for their high costs. The high cost of their drug utilization. But I think that's kind of muted a little bit once they have a real dialogue with a medical professional about what the alternatives are, etc. But there can be resistance, I think, by some prescribers.
Okay. Anne, you got another one for us? I think we'll take time for one more question.
Yeah. As gratifying as these drug companies' settlements are they large enough to dissuade these practices?
That's an excellent question. That's a fantastic question. So I would say, with one exception, I would say that they're not. As I said before, and I may have gone over kind of quickly, the $1.4 billion settlement with Eli Lilly about its off-label promotion of Zyprexa amounted to about 5% of the gross revenue that Lilly had made from selling Zyprexa. And so, a 5% fee or penalty is just the cost of doing business. Now, when Pfizer was forced to pay $2.3 billion for its promotion of four different drugs, that was more. It ended up being about 14% of their gross revenue from those drugs. And so I think that's better. That's a good move in the right direction. And I haven't done the analysis to see if the recent kind of big settlement with Abbott around the drug Depakote, it was $1.6 billion. I'm not sure what the amount there might be. But, you know, one state attorney general in Arkansas decided not to accept a settlement and took the manufacturer of Risperdal to court. And they didn't just seek to be kind of paid back for all of their spending on the drug. They actually sought damages, and I think it was about, you know, under their false claim statute at the state level, it was a $10,000 fee per false claim. And so at the trial court level, which is now being appealed, but at the trial court level, they won, I believe, a $2 billion settlement. And that's for one state, Arkansas. So, you know, if proportionally, if every state did the same thing, we'd be looking at $100 billion for in fines or settlements to that one manufacturer, right? And so I think that settlement is the exception that actually might make a difference. It might send a signal throughout the industry. Yeah, it might be a sufficient deterrent. Unfortunately, that $2 billion judgment is going to be appealed, and we're probably looking at, and this is because the legal system is just incredibly slow and inefficient, we're probably looking at 5 or 7 years before those appeals are done. So, but, you know, when I saw that settlement, I thought this could be a real game changer. We will have to see if other attorneys general continue to, you know, be as aggressive as the Arkansas Attorney General was.
Well, thank you very much, Wells. This has been really a terrific conversation we've had here. And you have a few more questions there, Anne?
They've asked us a question, but I guess what I might suggest to people on the calls in the various states is to contact their Attorney General's office, find out who has worked on those settlements, the assistant AGs, get a copy of this most recent settlement and take a look at the language. I'm guessing the language from state to state is pretty similar, if not exactly the same. And try to, I mean, there were a lot of great suggestions tonight in terms of what we as a collective might do if we could. But to think about organizations, whether it could be a medical association, or even the Medicaid program, and work with folks in writing a letter to the Attorney General, requesting some of that funding be used, to re-educate, providers and consumers around, that particular settlement and the drugs.
Sure. Well, if people want to email you directly, could you share your email address with us?
Sure. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, sure. It's my first initial W, and then my last name, Wilkinson, WILKINSON, @ communitycatalyst.org. And Anne, I think your idea is good. It would be great to get in touch with all the attorneys general, you know, right now, and ask them to, you know, take some action to fund prescriber education. And I think that request coming from physicians, you know, who are concerned about the quality of their prescribing and that of their, you know, colleagues, I think would be kind of compelling. I'd be happy to share, I've written a memo about this, which we've shared too, with some attorneys general. I'll be happy to share that with all of y'all if that would be at all helpful. And if anybody has any specific state AGs they want to reach out to, I have met a couple state AGs, about 15, I've met assistant AGs in about 15, maybe 20 different states who are very sympathetic to this work and have, you know, litigated the cases on behalf of their state Medicaid programs. And, you know, I think at that junior level, they are very sympathetic. So we wanted me to help introduce somebody to an assistant AG who's worked on one of these cases to talk about, you know, how best to kind of weigh in with the Attorney General of that state. I'd be happy to introduce people if I know somebody.
I hear a new project developing here.
Yeah. And I one final thing I just want to throw out is if there are states without programs interested in starting a program, there is a great resource, the National Resource Center for Academic Detailing, and they provide information on how to get started with programs and resources, how to start programs and resources available for starting programs. You may want to check that out as well.
So we've come to the end of our hour here, so we do need to end the call now. I would like to just remind people that our next thank you so much, Wells. You were terrific. Our next conflict-free call will be in approximately 2 months. These are every 2 months, these calls. It's a 3-year project. I guess we're going into the next year now. It's been a year, I think, this month.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. So watch your email for the date and information and speaker. And, again, for more information about the National Physicians Alliance and this project, you can visit npalliance.org. And for more information on the AMHSA Farm Free Scorecard, another great project, visit amhsascorecard.org. Anything else, Ann?
No, thanks, everybody, for joining us.
All right, and we will get written notes on the call that we'll be sharing.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Take care. Thank you for all the great ideas, too. I really appreciate it.
All right.